The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
Hello and welcome into the Anomic Age once again. I'm your host, John Age. It's a pleasure to be back with you. Had a few days off here, and I missed being here. Missed being in the show. Nevertheless, check out AnomicAge.com if you have not already done so. Do it. We got a great guest for you today. We got Mr. Hunter Watkins coming up in just a bit. But make sure and check out AnomicAge.com. You can still download the app for the iPhone, for the Android. You can check out all the links for all the guests. Every single show ever in Anomic Age history is there, the video and the audio. As I always say, it's free for you, but it's certainly not free for me. So if you have a little extra quan, if you are so inclined, paypal.me/AnomicAge, and you can make it a regular thing at patreon.com/AnomicAge2. All that and much, much more can be found at AnomicAge.com. So share that link, friends, family, loved ones, and enemies, and stick around for just a few because we will be with our guest in just a mere matter of moments on the other side. Welcome Mr. Hunter Watkins into the Anomic Age today. Hunter was born in the Outer Banks of North Carolina and has the ability to effectively communicate his philosophy with the golf swing and its relationship with music. His expertise in putting short game and full swing mechanics make him a valuable asset to Marine Park Golf Club. Hunter's passion for the game of golf, combined with his teaching and playing experience, make him one of the most sought-after golf professionals in New York, New Jersey, and the North Carolina region. Built Summer Hills Golf Studios to bridge the gap between music and golf just a few years ago. Thank you so much, Hunter, for being on the show. It's a pleasure.
Oh, great to be with you, John. Great.
I'm excited. We've been trying to do this for a couple weeks now. I'm glad we're finally making it happen.
You know, 2020 is kind of strange. You know, I seemingly remember a time where we didn't have to go through all the hoops. And then, you know, obviously, you weren't feeling so good. So I'm glad you're back on the mend. In New York, they go, the men's a men. You're back on the men's a men.
Indeed, man. Well, we got to touch on this because we were talking a little bit about it before we got rolling here today, and I was going to bring it up anyway. I mean, I don't usually get into the pop culture or the normal culture, if you will, but we got to talk about the passing of the great guitar virtuoso, Eddie Van Halen. I mean, that one hit me a little bit hard as well, and I'm nowhere near the musician that you are, so.
Well, yeah, where to start? I mean, the beginning, the alpha, the omega, you know, for people like me that were born in a certain time, that were influential as far as, or, you know, basically having that sort of ear to what music was all about. When we heard Eddie Van Halen, it was just like, you know, what is this? I mean, the expression, you know, tearing your head off, you know, as far as musically, dynamically, sonically, Eddie Van Halen really epitomized what you sort of imagined that guitar could be. You know, when you hear Clapton, which was Eddie's number one influence, so Eddie oftentimes in interviews or whatever would say that Clapton is, you know, his guitar god. But, you know, the difference between the two is pretty profound. But when you really just get the perspective of, I was reading some of the comments. I actually didn't even have the wherewithal to be able to contribute my two cents into social media because of just the sick feeling. You know, I mean, it's not very often that, you know, when a celebrity or whatever passes that I just kind of go, wow, and take stock of my own life. You know, I mean, that's really the best way to say it is like, man, where were you when? How, you know, all it was really that sort of perspective check for me. So I really had to just sit back and just read and sort of be in a place of just really, you know, he was so big that it was bigger than music. I mean, he was people's childhood. He was the soundtrack to college, to high school. I mean, you know, this is something that is bigger than just his individual passing. He had such an effect, a profound effect. While you hear me rambling, you know, to ask me about Eddie Van Halen, like, you know, how much time do we have? You know, I mean, that's
true, man. I mean, I'm right there with you. I remember when I first heard Hot for Teacher, which is, I think, the first time I even really saw MTV. My parents and I were at a conference. My mom had a conference. I think it was in Raleigh. It might have been Charlotte, but I was sitting there in the hotel room, and this video came on. The visuals for the video, we'll just put aside, but the guitar in the video, you know, that's what transcended it all. That's why I was still listening to it some 40, you know, some 11 years later. You know? Yeah. And if you look at all his work, you think, oh, it was just Van Halen, and you forget, oh, he had parts, I think it was in Billy Idol, some of his hits. He had parts in Michael Jackson, The Hook, in some of his records. Back to the Future, you could just look all throughout that 80s landscape, and Eddie Van Halen's prints are all over it. So, well, transcendent.
Yeah, it's not often that you sort of become this incredible mega band throughout the 70s and into the 80s and whatnot, lose your singer, right? Lose a critical part of the band. Obviously, Dave was, you know, the first word, you know, everybody's thinking right now is showman, right? So he's a showman. Before he's a singer, he's sort of a showman. And if you ever saw Van Halen back in the day, a great show, unbelievable show. But Van Halen actually reinvented themselves, you know, with the, you know, entrance of Sammy into the band. And so the contrasting sort of you know, musicality, as it were, you know, Eddie cites that Sammy was a better vocalist and capable of doing more range. And so it made Eddie a better writer is, you know, the thing that was always perpetuated about the transition. But reinventing themselves, you know, with that sort of same core with Eddie and Alex. But, you know, went to number one, you know, when they had Dreams and a couple other songs, post records. I mean, Why Can't This Be Love? Just really, really great stuff. So two incarnations of Van Halen. Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
Kind of like you, it sort of struck me in a weird way because you start thinking about your own mortality. And I mean, for me, I was just thinking, man, am I really that old where I've got these epic figures from childhood that are passing on? I mean, that seems insane. But then you look at the shot clock and you're like, well, dang, I guess I am kind of getting near that demographic. So,
right. Weird. You know, that doing stock in one's own sort of, you know, contributions is the thing that's difficult. You know, it really is because, I was super, super blessed. Back in 1984, a friend of my mom's, who wasn't actually in the music business, was in the clothing business and the wholesale business, had a vendor's license to sell at the Fabulous Forum in Inglewood, California. And the Fabulous Forum was a pretty famous place, and it was famous for not having a backstage. It actually was a true event hall with nothing but it was all seats all the way around. So if you were an artist that was playing at the Fabulous Forum, you actually had to enter from the side and then proceed down, you know, half of the venue, as it were, to get to backstage. So there was a tremendous amount of excitement. I basically got in on the ground level with some people that actually worked selling T-shirts and doing vendor types of stuff. And when they were kicking everybody out of the forum, I got to stay around a little bit longer. And lo and behold, Mr. Eddie emerged, and his father came out, and they sat down in the very stands in the riser section. And I was up quite a few levels higher, but it was apparent who it was. And I was just beside myself that I didn't have a pen. You know, really, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So I'm almost looking around everywhere, getting ready to fly down those stairs. And I can't find a pen. I'm running around looking for something, a marker, whatever. And I run into this lady, and I get the feeling God must have put her there, you know, as I look back on it for sure. And I was like, ma'am, I was like, I need a pen or a marker. And she had this bag. She opened up this little bag and had the most incredible selection of markers. You just kill that phone right there. She had the most incredible selection of markers and gave me one. And I proceeded to run down those stairs and spend probably about 10 minutes with Eddie and his dad and you know, asking the dumbest questions. You know, I was like, oh, so how long have you been playing guitar? He turned and looked at his dad, was like, you know, like this is really, you know, a moment. And he started asking about me, and he sort of knew from my question that I play guitar. And so he turned it all on me, and these were his exact words. He said, kid, if you want to be where I'm standing right now, you can do it. And I took those words home, you know, as well as this, we'll break this out. Not only did I get to take the words home, but I got to bring this home too.
Oh, and, man.
Yeah. What dumb thing. I wore it to school. Bancroft Junior High School, wore it the next day, and some kid dotted me up somewhere around here. Some kid dotted me with his pen. I was like, I'm never wearing that thing again in my life. I'm going to get it framed.
Yeah.
But he was so positive and so absolutely amazing. You know, if you meet the wrong musician in your life, you may never play that your instrument again. You know, I've heard stories of session players and some famous guys in New York, actually, that met their childhood hero and you know, not necessarily what they thought it was going to be. But for me, what a blessing. You know, Eddie was the coolest, and getting to talk with his father, Jan Van, who was a monster, by the way.
Really?
I mean, this guy, you know, he was standing. I was like, dude, this guy was—he was a beast. And for some reason, Eddie wasn't that tall, but when I shook his hand, his hand just like engulfed mine. Like, so for like a smaller type of guy, he had the biggest damn hands. I mean, there is no joke. I mean, I guess that's what gave him some prowess, you know, on the old guitar there for sure. But what an amazing moment and impacted my entire life, as you can probably tell.
Yeah, man, that's wild. Good grief. I had no idea that you got to meet Eddie Van Halen. I saw that sort of behind you there in the center, but I didn't know what it was. That's cool.
Yeah, you know, just in fact, I got so many calls yesterday by people that know me really well, knowing I was probably in rough shape. lose Eddie Van Halen. Hunter sort of, you know, loves that guy to death. And, you know, we're, you know, just taking stock, you know, really, you know, I was listening to some of the songs. Even we have some cassette recordings from back in the early 77s to where it's considered bootleg. So there's a song Down in Flames, that's an original Van Halen song, and another song called Bullet Head. So there are original Van Halen songs that will probably be making it to some sort of release, but Down in Flames and Bullet Head, two original Van Halen songs that are phenomenal if you can find them on the internet.
Man, well, one of the things that really struck me when we first started talking and I got to know you was your connection to the punk and hardcore scene as well. Like, that's one of those things from my blast of the past, a notebook, I really connect to that old punk and hardcore stuff and skateboarding and all that stuff still, even though from where I am now, it's probably like 180 degrees the opposite direction, but it was really fascinating that you came from that same sort of background and you actually got to speak with some of the guys in Bad Brains and hang out with them as well too, and just sort of how that influenced your golf game and right. Just who you are today. I mean, the music's still very much part of things, so that was pretty fascinating as well. If you could talk about that a little bit, that'd be neat.
Yeah, a friend of mine came down from Philadelphia. pretty sure it was my freshman year in high school, and said, "Hey, have you ever heard this band? You know, from DC, they're called the Bad Brains." I'm like, "No, never heard of the Bad Brains." And you put in the tape, and I was like, "What in the world?" You know, the energy. You know, it's difficult to talk about Van Halen in sort of the impactful sort of way that you sort of assimilate. You know, if you're the board, you know, taking music in. Van Halen affects you a certain way, but the energy of the Bad Brains, I mean, it was unbridled. You know, it was raw. It was like, holy moly, another type of, you know, mega type of powerful group. Now, you know, in different sort of, rooted in different sorts of, you know, foundations. You know, you have Eddie Van Halen and, you know, blues, Clapton sort of style. And, you know, the Bad Brains sort of a jazzy type of background, but also, you know, loving the reggae and the hardcore. So, the Bad Brains, as far as their contribution, they were up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think it was just 2 years ago. And, you know, they don't have that sort of critical acclaim that would get them, you know, sort of nominated, but they have like the street absolute reputation of being, I mean, if you go to a Bad Brains show, you're going to see a lot of musicians from other bands there. Like, I want to go see the Bad Brains. I want to see what this is all about, because they've been able to encapsulate that energy. And, you know, is there a wild card sort of a presence to it? You know, their singer, HR, you know, has had some of these types of issues that has brought the wrong type of attention to the Bad Brains and given them a little bit more of a hurdle that they maybe didn't need to overcome. So, you know, with the press sort of maligning them a little bit, I mean, did certain things happen as far as, you know, incidents that they weren't proud of course. But then, you know, the manipulation of the industry, you know, I won't say who. Okay, yeah, I will. Madonna and Maverick really break them over the coals. You know, granted, there was contractual stipulations that they couldn't provide on sort of certain sides or whatever, but the music business gets, you know, really, really ugly, really, really ugly. And I've had music attorneys say, you know, Hunter, musicians have no place in the meetings that take place about your band. And I was like offended by that. A really great music attorney, Mike Turok, who represented some great folks, said to me, he's like, Hunter, he goes, you know, we're talking about him potentially shopping some music in New York for us. And he was like, you would not want to be in those meetings. And that's really the truth. The music business is ugly, and it is, it's controlled in certain ways that are tough, and they're toughest on the musicians themselves. And getting to play with Daryl from the Bad Brains after the Bad Brains sort of went on to like a type of hiatus mode, Daryl would play with different types of groups. He would play, he always would play with Rick Ocasek from the Cars, like whenever Rick, you know, wanted Daryl, Jennifer to come, you know, obviously when Rick calls, you go. Other folks, but the Bad Brains sort of did guest singers, alternative drummers. So they had a rotating lineup for a little period of time, which also led to different types of projects. But The Shining Path was a project that we were in with different members from different types of groups, from Roguish Armament, from Dog Eat Dog, all sort of like hardcore New York bands at the time. But Roguish was a little bit more rap-centered. Roguish Armament, you guys want to check them out online on YouTube, Roguish Armament, like you really see some authentic New York City hip-hop. But The Shining Path, very, very difficult to find a trace of that band that we were in. A neat story behind that as well. We basically played a show with some of the Roots, the members of the Roots at this place called Wetlands in New York City. And one of the most exciting shows I've ever been a part of, as far as everything going right. Our singer, Danny Ilchuk, one of the singers, Chip Love and Danny Ilchuk, he used pyrotechnics in his hand. He basically had these things that he bought in Chinatown, right, that he was telling everybody about. He's like, wait, did you guys see what I'm going to do? And I was like, all right, we're going to see you. So we're running through the set and doing these songs, and the amount of energy was insane, you know, probably one of the coolest shows ever. And Danny has these things in his hand. He turns around, does all this move. He's got these samurai swords and stuff. And he pulls these pyrotechnics that are in his hand and shoots these crazy flames out of his hands. I mean, the kids' faces and everything, like my face, I was like, oh, my God. Like, you know, this is incredible.
That's crazy.
You were on top of New York, like all the press, the Village Voice, everything was talking about, oh, this new band, The Shining Path. The very next gig, I mean, it was virtually a showcase is what they call it in New York, was where everyone from every label comes out because they heard that you're the thing. We had, as at the Knitting Factory, the next show. Oh, boy. Let's see. Trying to find words for this one. Yikes. Thought it would be a good idea to bring somebody new in just for some complimentary type of stuff. And they ended up kicking a side out, which eliminated, I think, three or four of the bands just in one pull out of a plug into our amps and keyboards and all the supporting types of mechanisms and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
So we were sunk. It was the worst performance in front of the most influential crowd. And, if I told you that drug addiction followed for a lot of the bands for getting on, like, hard drugs, like where you're totally worried about them. I mean, went from amazing types of promise to, you know, the lowest of the lows. And also with a record deal with Jive, Roguish Armament had a big record deal on the table with this guy, Dante Ross, producing. And, I've seen it. You know, I've seen what happens to when they're doing amazingly well, and I've seen what happens to people when it turns upside down. And that music business is not necessarily the thing for everybody. And Daryl from the Bad Brains actually said to me, he's like, Hunter, you should be a golf pro. You know, he was like, and he was being serious, and he wasn't trying to be insulting. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's the stuff that we all go through. I mean, you know, the difficulty of that industry. And he really saw, I don't know if I would have turned golf professional if it wasn't for Daryl Jennifer. So, you know, thanks, D. You know, Big D coming through and, you know, really sort of pushing me in a direction. And he was influential, you know, like Eddie Van Halen was as far as shaping that direction. You know, really, really just giving me the sort of courage because it was difficult. I had a wife. My wife had actually said at the time, you know, after 9/11, it was a crucial time in this country. I had an appointment actually downtown Manhattan, September 11, 2001, at 11:15 in the morning. And, just crazy times. But my wife sort of gave me an ultimatum. She's like, I love you and everything, but you got to make some dough now. She's like, you've got to figure out a way to be successful. And at the same time, you know, I'm hearing Daryl say, you know, do the golf thing. And, you know, it happened. Yeah. I mean, and technically you're supposed to be accredited, you know, a PGA member, you know, like all this sort of stuff. I just went looking for the jobs and I somehow got the jobs. I don't know how to explain that to you, but, I basically decided to turn professional over one winter, and my very first job that I got was as a PGA, it's called a level, well, I would be, it's actually an A position, even though I wasn't an A, they called me a B. So it's a PGA B. That means when you're not in the PGA, but you have a head professional position. So classifying me as all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, you know, you've got to register in these programs. I'm like, but I already got the job, you know, and they're like, okay. And then, so it was a little weird in the beginning to not be a PGA member, and getting these jobs. And, I think my third or fourth head professional position without being a PGA member the PGA actually came to me. We ran these programs called PGA Tour clinics, and it was quite extensive. And so, strangely enough, if you continue to get work, they'll come to you. This is actually, as you can see, I'm a little bit sort of on the fence with the PGA, right? The PGA sort of has a monopoly a little bit on being a golf professional. Like, if you're not a PGA professional, there's some sort of discrimination that might come your way. And it's peculiar in the sense that the criteria that used to encapsulate being a member of the PGA was very localized, and then it became very nationalized. So not too many years ago, your local sort of orientation would determine whether you became a member or not. And now it's a national type of program where wherever you are, it's sort of based out of Florida. Now, me being a little bit old school, you know, about it, I just have a little bit of the old section type of affiliation. So I really like the sections. You know, the Metropolitan PGA section in New York is probably one of my favorite. The Carolina section, I'm not too familiar with the folks down here just yet, but the local orientation for PGA pros, that's where you really sort of, you know, make that big difference. And if your local peers sort of, you know, it used to be just a different process. I'll just say it like that.
Well, that's wild. I didn't realize Daryl from the Bad Brains had such an impact on you going into the golf game a little bit. That's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, just he's a super nice guy and an incredible musician. And I think we have one of his instruments around here somewhere, a modulus bass. He's made this called the Green Monster. He's made a bass famous for having its own name, you know. So we have his twin brother around here waiting for him, waiting for Daryl. Come on down Summerhill. Come on, Daryl.
That'd be cool. If he does, let me know. I'm going to come over there and meet him and hang out.
No worries.
Yeah, it's funny. I talked to a guy that goes by the name of Rat Skates, who was the original drummer and I guess like founder of Overkill, the metal band.
Right.
And he had a similar story as regarding the music industry, and pretty much I think he still retains the name and copyrights or whatever, but he's not in Overkill anymore. He's doing documentaries and he's a Christian conservative and talking about sort of the pitfalls of the music industry. And he was saying a lot of the same stuff regarding all the nonsense you go through where you've built this band, you've made your brand, you've toured the world and toured cities or whatever. And then it kind of comes down to these executives and lawyers and labels and all this nonsense. So he just kind of had enough and he checked out of all that, but definitely not not a new story, it seems.
Yeah, you know, I think if you had sort of the grassroots type of essence to it that allowed it to flourish in a sort of unmolested, unmanipulated way, but whenever you put that big money, that carrot out there in front of people, you know, strange things, you know, sort of happen. And, you know, it's almost a sort of metaphor for what we have going on now. You know, like we have people that are sort of willing to sacrifice certain types of integrity points, as it were, or something, maybe morale standards to where, you know, they might sort of let something pass in order to gain financially or gain, you know, in a power sort of sense. So I'm really sort of in a different place with the politics, you know, right now, because I see what's happening and I see it's basically propaganda, you know, Bernays, you know, and his book and all of the sort of minions that followed, you know, through the manipulation of the masses has really just reached this sort of level of people have got to make a change, and they've got to make a change from watching Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and CBS and The sort of programming is so high that we are the Native Americans had a thing that they called Wetiko. And Wetiko is when you basically can distress someone so much with fear that they actually disconnect from all that they are supposed to be connected to. You know, really, you know, your connection to, you know, the Heavenly Father is like probably one of the most important things as far as just for your, you know, your whisper of a hunch. You know, sometimes when, you know, you're getting ready to do something, I'm going to climb up on the roof and clean them gutters out or something, and then something says, not today, Steve.
That discernment kicks in, or at least it should. Says, don't do that, John. It's a bad idea.
Well, right. You know, so like you get these hunches, and you know, sometimes those hunches can be like the direct sort of intervention of a heavenly, you know, father trying to protect you. I'm not saying in all, you know, instances Steve is not going to jump up on the roof, but if you are in a state of fear, if you're in a state of panic, you are not going to hear the whisper, the message, the stomach sort of getting a little butterfly and getting you to sort of alter your perspective. The Native American Wetiko is a mind virus. And that mind virus is so powerful that people don't even know whether they're on the right or whether they're on the left. The people on the left are scared of the people on the right, and the people on the right are scared of the people on the left, and it's a very, very calculated program that we all understand. When I have my extremely left-leaning, I mean, crazy left-leaning friends over here in the studio, we sit and we talk, and we virtually agree on just about everything, except for, you know, the socialism, capitalism thing. Except for, you know, the sort of biblical thing, you know, the God, the creation, you know, versus the God. You know, so there's a few of the major types of differences. But when we boil everything else out, we are saying the same exact things. And I'm not a right-wing conservative. I'm a actual constitutionalist. So I believe in the Constitution as it was written. If something's wrong with the Constitution, then, you know, it's made for an amendment, you know. So we can go through the process of changing the things that aren't necessarily in the spirit of God or in the spirit of equality or, you know, the pursuit of happiness. What I see now is that people on the right and the left are so disconnected because of the fear-based propaganda. And it's really sad, you know, it's really sad. Because as I said, you know, when we have the brass tacks, the guys that when they come over know what the hell they're talking about on the left. There are people that know exactly, that are very intelligent, that know exactly, you know, what they want to say about the programs or whatever. And when you start talking with them, you realize that increasing the net worth of billionaires to the degree that, you know, Jeff Bezos has doubled his net worth. It's been over $629 billion that have been added to the coffers of the people that were already billionaires. Now, there's a perspective that is obtained from the people on the extreme left and the extreme right, where I almost had these thoughts in my head where, like, there has to be a left-right alliance if you're saying the same exact thing. There has to, if you're, you know, sort of people that you're friends with, you know, and I have militant sort of left-wing people I'm friends with in New York. I see their Facebook posts. Don't often agree with a lot of the stuff. But if you go to a George Soros's home, if you go to a George Soros's, if Black Lives Matter went to Soros's house and protested at Soros's house, I'm joining. Right. I'm joining.
Exactly.
There's no doubt. Like, you, if you sort of are grassroots in what you're trying to do, I am with it 100%. But to sort of use, and we've seen the ads, the Craigslist ads for way too long. We know how much people get paid. We know the incentivization for agitation, for becoming an agitprop. We understand that the PSYOP of what they're doing is a paid one, which means it's astroturf, right? So it's of an astroturf origin. As I said, if this got really serious and BLM was going to go rock at Soros's crib, count me in. Might even get a tattoo right? You go to Soros's house, I might get a tattoo on my face, right? But I don't know.
Oh, that's man.
But I'm just saying, you know, that's what America is all about, is protesting, but in a certain type of way, and understanding who's causing, you know, the issues. If black folks and white folks didn't have these divisive types of things that are perpetuated in the media blocking them, we would be unstoppable. I mean, you know, guys like Bob Marley and even Stevie Wonder and the people that were really trying to unify culture are not the sort of people that they're not looking up to the Marleys. They're not, you know, seeing, you know, through not paying attention to history that you're going to repeat what has gone on. And now the players are a little bit different, but it's the same sort of strategy. So, you know, I get along with people on the extreme left because we know the same people are benefiting. We are watching the same structure sort of unfold, and not real thrilled about it. You know, not real thrilled about the inaction towards the people. Nelson Mandela wrote George Soros a handwritten letter. Dear Mr. Soros, please tell me how I can protect South Africa from people like yourself. Why would Mandela write Soros a letter saying, please tell me how to protect South Africa from people like you? Yeah, you don't hear that on the news.
No. Well, I mean, I think to your point, they're doing exactly what they want to do. They're dividing everybody. They love putting people in little boxes. So if you fit the Antifa profile, or if you fit, you know, fill in the blank of your antithesis on the right, they're happy. Yeah. They love that. They want the divide and conquer. They want the clash of civilizations model. So what makes them real uncomfortable is people like ourselves that don't really fit into the box. I mean, that's perfect for me. I mean, I feel from kind of childhood on, I never fit into the box. Even looking back at the punk and hardcore and skating and all that stuff I was into, I was still the oddball, even in the land of misfit toys. I'm cool with it. I mean, at 42, I'm happy as a clam, just not fitting in. So that's fine. I don't have to put a big R on my chest and run out there with a flag and all that stuff. I don't have to don the Antifa ninja outfit either. I mean, it's just, that's what they want you to do. I wish that by and large, the American people would wake up and just say, hey, stop. Stop putting on the outfit. Just chill out. Let's get together. We'll group up. We'll talk about this.
Yeah. Carlin had a great point about flag wavers. You know, George Carlin talked about, you know, if you've got to, you know, just wave your flag and you, you know, you have some sort of ideological connection to the flag that you're waving, well, then you may not really be a part of the big thing. You know, the big thing doesn't see flags as sort of separation. And I've been very blessed. I've been married for 22 years to a woman from another country. And so she's from South Korea. So I actually get to go to South Korea and experience like another world. And one of the most amazing things, like I was a little nervous my first trip to South Korea. I'm like, man, you know, not only is it like 16 hours to get here, I was like 16 hours on the plane. I really didn't know what to do. I mean, I was like, this is going to be unreal. So I tried to stay up late. And then the first thing I did, like, I ordered two beers. The waitress looked at me. She's like, you want two? I'm like, please. You know, I was trying to just have two beers and just somehow go to sleep. It doesn't work that way. You know, there's no amount of beer that's going to make that 16 hours any shorter. But we land in Incheon International Airport. And I'm sort of, you know, it's like 4:15 in the morning or something like that. And we're getting into the taxi and we're getting ready to go to Seoul. And we leave like this, it's all foggy and these crazy bridges that's on this reclaimed land that they actually built where the airport is. And they built a Nicholas golf course there. It's really incredible. But we're pulling in. And as soon as we get to where I'll call it like civilization, which looked like the city on the outskirts of Seoul, the sort of fog cleared a little bit. And I looked and I saw the countryside for the very first time. And being, you know, an American showing up in Korea for the first time, I looked all around and I was like, it took my breath away because there were crosses, red cross, only red red crosses across the entire, as far as the eye could see. So as a person that was going to, you know, sort of, you know, being a little bit like, hey, this is new, you know, territory for me or whatever, you know, and even, you know, having a wife that's Korean, you know, you're still nervous. And I got there and I saw the crosses all across the entire landscape. I was like, I felt amazing. I mean, I felt like, wow, like there is nothing for me to worry about here at all. Like I'm completely surrounded by people that, you know, it's difficult. I look back because, you know, being an evangelist is tough. When I get to those moments, like right then, when I sort of stop and have to think about something, the harboring of jumping up and down for God has been sort of the limitations that I've put on my life, you know, for a long time. It's like when I really want to say that I'm so thankful to be a Christian, that all the things that have sort of been brought into my life are a direct result of Him, there's these limitations. So right then you got to actually see it in real time, you know, almost a filter of not being able to say the tremendous amount of joy and comfort and everything that sort of hit me when I saw those crosses. It was as if I was home. Isn't that weird?
That's beautiful.
It was really like I was home. Like, and my wife, she's like, I think she says, honey, you could go to an insurance seminar and have a good time. I'm like, hey, thanks. Hey, I'm here all week. But, you know, that feeling to know that, you know, Christ is in charge and that the people that are possibly around you are Christians and that there's no fear. And that sort of having no fear could really be an important type of aspect, you know, for today. You know, today, you know, so many people are terrified. And that mind virus, the Native American Wetiko mind virus, has corrupted their files. Their files now won't load in their computer because everything has been usurped from the mainline perspective. And there's a neat thing. I haven't worn a mask in these 205 days. I go wherever I go. And was the New Hanover County Courthouse a couple weeks ago and walked in, signs all over the place, you must have a mask to enter this building. I walk in and I'm smiling, I'm greeting the police officers. Not one person said anything to me. I go to the grocery store yesterday. I go wherever, I am not a person that's going to be wearing a mask. And the fear of what people are going through is what we're almost having a little bit of a sort of bending point at our church. Korean people are very diligent. I've been a member of a Korean church, I think, the past 15, 17 years, different churches, but for the past 17 years, I've been involved with Korean churches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you want to talk about when you're given these standards of cleanliness and hygiene and all this sort of stuff, Korean people are going to overdo it, right? So the first session back, you know, with this phase two or whatever in our church, the Wilmington Korean Presbyterian Church, our folks went above, I mean, from, you know, the infrared scanners to the hand sanitizers to the face masks to then the full, they were beekeepers. I mean,
literally
multiple, you know, coverings, you know, not just the shields, but the masks and all the stuff. It was really amazing. And I sort of have been talking with our pastor saying, if we're so caught up into this nervous type of rigid type of fear, it's going to be difficult to connect with the sermons, you know. So we're really trying to influence some people in a way that is going to be positive. And the masks and the fear and the propaganda is not the positives. You know, there's a lot of people that are going to hear what I'm saying right now and just be completely mad. They're going to be like, oh, how can that guy go out to the grocery store and whatever and not wear a mask? This is the first time in history, in the history of the world, that people that are not sick have been quarantined. This is the first time in the history of the world that people that are not sick are forced to wear masks. If you look at anything in history, you'll realize that this is the big one. This is the sort of play for it all. And, you know, where Trump has sort of made some really big mistakes, in my opinion, is sort of the perpetuation that the vaccines and the military rolling these out and through this is the hope that you need to not be terrified.
Yeah.
I do have, you know, a problem with that, you know, and I mean, does it mean that, you know, I hate Trump? No. Does it mean that I love Trump? No. Does it mean that I objectively criticize him every day and would give him credit for the things, like if you ask me about, you know, the unemployment and the stock market and the other types of things that are a big concern to Americans, I'll say, hey, did a fabulous job domestically. He's done some really great things. But when you talk about the asset allocation and how much money is being poured into these directions that are really scary, that's where he's making some big, you know, sort of mistakes, you know, and even in his treatment, you know, the remdesivir, you know,
that was insane.
You talk about, you know, a certain type of angle on things and talk about your, hydroxychloroquine and all these, azithromycin and, you know, this type of stuff. And then you go for the Dr. Fauci patent, you know, you go for really the remdesivir, you know, when AIDS came out, Fauci was like, you'll need remdesivir for AIDS. When swine flu came out, Fauci said, you need remdesivir for swine flu. Whenever something comes out, Fauci's
the record broke again because it keeps coming back.
Right. And I encourage anybody out there that wants to find some truth, 1986, the act. You want to see where it all began. 1986, the act. Dr. Fauci standing right next to Ronald Reagan, basically releasing any manufacturer of any responsibility for any drugs that get put into our general populace. So Dr. Fauci, 1986, Ronald Reagan, everybody says, oh, Reagan, he's so fantastic. Well,
got a little bad. Not with the vaccine bill.
That's right. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way about Trump. I mean, I realize this is probably why I'm never going to be a politician, but I want to come out there firing at the debate and just going, hey, this thing's a scam. I'm not wearing a mask because it's a scam. If you have this, hydroxychloroquine, Z-Pack, zinc, call it a day. I'm not gonna entertain these idiots and pretend this is anything less than a scam. I mean, that would have been blasphemous, and I'm sure he'd lost the election on that. But I don't know. In my opinion, I think there's a whole lot more American people that know what's up than don't. And I think a vast majority of the public would have been, man, it's about time somebody came out with the truth. Great, let's get back to work. Okay, move on. I mean, come on, man.
It's very scary. You know, it's very scary when someone, and you know, there's a movie called The Obama Deception, right?
Oh,
the
yeah.
Obama Deception, pretty interesting movie as far as the comparison of what was said to what was done, right? So what was said and then what was done. The whole movie is basically like that. It's like, this is what he said, this is what he did. And it's not really, you know, too much, you know, interjection of anybody else's thought. It's just, this is what he said, this is what he did. So if you watch that movie, you get a really sort of wonderful idea about politics in how people will say one thing and do another. Now, when Obama was elected, I was like, man, you know, oh, this is awesome. You know, like, we got a black president, like stuff is going to change, you know, like, you know, that's, you know, his platform that he actually ran on. But, you know, unfortunately, we saw something that wasn't met for the types of direction that was proposed in the beginning. Now, the thing with Trump is a little bit more disconcerting because he's built an incredibly loyal base, right? So the moves that someone now makes are less magnified because of the overall love for him, right? So, oh no, he, you know, I know that guy. He wouldn't, you know, do it, you know. So that is where politics get, you know, kind of tricky. And so if you give someone a pass, right, like, see, if Hillary was elected, everyone would scrutinize every one of her moves. Anything that sort of came down would be like, you know, met with this tremendous type. But when Trump does it, like the sort of magnifying glasses are off. I look at things with magnifying glasses all the time. I don't care who said it. You can't have this unbridled loyalty to a types of figure where, they get a pass on everything that gets, sort of done. Not a chance in hell. Can't do that.
That's exactly what the Edward Bernays thing was all about, the propaganda. It was using celebrities to galvanize public opinion and to shape the mind.
Yeah.
So, you get this all the time if you talk to anybody just about the sports figure. Oh, well, I trust LeBron because I've watched him for 20 years. He's a great player. Or I love this character. It's even worse when they do it to a sitcom star. Oh, this is my favorite character. And they can't differentiate the character from the person. And they can't differentiate the athlete that plays the sport from the athlete that's a real three-dimensional person that's not that guy with the ball. It's the guy pushing an agenda. It's the guy or girl that's the sitcom star that's pushing an agenda. It's not the character they play on your favorite show. People can't seem to grasp that. And I think that's what contributes to this a lot. And the same with the president, where they'll I love Trump. He's the antithesis of the communist trash Hillary, but doesn't mean he's not making some questionable moves here and there. Some quite questionable, even given lip services, vaccine garbage, I think is monstrous. I would never support that in any way, shape, or form.
It's easy to be, flippant. And someone that would be hearing this conversation that we're having, could easily say, that they just must be questioning vaccines or they're anti-vaxxers. There's names for the people like us now.
Oh, yeah, they create those, just like the conspiracy theory moniker.
Well, it's funny because I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro-vaccine, 100% pro-vaccine. I just don't need thimerosal. I don't need adjuvants. I don't need nanoparticulate. I don't
need MSG for me, thanks.
Well, you're going to tell me that there needs to be a mercury element, a liquid metal, as a preservative in my vaccine? Let me see. The last time that I checked, mercury wasn't so good for inside the body. The liquid metal aspect, is sort of dangerous, right? So if you provide a clean vaccine, which are available to some of the public, there are these insurance agencies that provide, and they're very high end. I only heard of them, and one of the names was Oxford, right? Oxford. You have these certain types of unbelievably high income types of insurance, you get some pretty good vaccines. You don't get the stuff that you get, when
Not
you're
the
on
free stuff from CVS, huh?
Right. When I saw the flu shots at McDonald's, I think I almost ralphed. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
I even missed that. I know they had those at McDonald's too.
It's like, really? But, no one has read a vaccine information sheet, right? If you've read a vaccine information sheet, or I shouldn't say no one has read one. If you're a pro-vaccine person, then you probably haven't read a VIS, a vaccine information sheet. If you have read either from Merck or Pfizer or, any of the ones, when they go into the part about you actually dying because you got the vaccination, and then the act that Fauci and Reagan pushed through, the indemnity of the zero culpability responsibility that anyone plays in your death. I was born at night, but it wasn't last night, So, if you just critically think for a little bit about, you'll start to draw these conclusions that are very different than sort of mainstream populace and what Trump is sort of pushing. The fact that the money for the test kits, the PCR, the person that invented the PCR test deemed it not possible to determine any sort of positive or negative affiliation of any viral count in any person. It's not to be used to determine whether they have a virus. It's a very specific type of test that only can pick up very small types of particulate and viral particulate, and then sort of convey whether you had it at any period of time. There's no amount that it sort of detects. It's only whether it was there or not there at any point in your life. So the false positives, which I look at this, it's a whole nother world. And if you want the truth in this, John, you follow the money, right?
Exactly.
Follow the money. You go, what's the truth about the tests? What's the truth? Football players, 77 NFL football players, all tested positive, right? How is that possible? Well, they go in and they take four tests the next week, all of them negative. So the 77 that were tested that weren't going to be playing then got retested four times, all proving that that one chance test was a false positive. The PGA Tour, I heard out of Sergio Garcia's mouth after playing with a person that was diagnosed with COVID-19 that he should retest and retest again. He said he felt fine. I'm watching professional athletes, right? Here's your money. Here's your livelihood.
Exactly.
Here's the testing. And here's the TV. The TV's right here. The TV's on. You got COVID? Did you test positive? Here's the reaction of other players. When you put the money in front of the pro athletes and you involve the testing in it, you'll find the truth. You'll find it. And the truth is, if you don't like your diagnosis of being COVID positive, test again and test again and test again, because the odds are you don't have it.
Call me crazy. That doesn't sound like science at all. I love these fools that trust the science. Trust the science. Well, it's like a lottery system. Okay, I'm positive. Come on, negative. Roll the dice again. All right, negative. Whew, I'm clear. I'm good to go.
Yeah, I mean, if you're scared about something, then they got you.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Oh, you're scared. Oh, you're worried about a test. Oh, you know, and the things that we started doing as a household back in March. We started fortifying basically our immune systems through all the essentials. The things that if someone's really authentically worried, either with a pre-existing condition or something about COVID, they should fortify themselves and not with vaccines and chemicals and that sort of thing. But literally the essential vitamins and minerals. Amazing. And Fauci came out 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, and finally said it. I didn't know if I was really mad that day, you know, March months and months of practicing way more than normal, because it's brought a new sort of focus to having zinc in your cells, of getting enough D3, of having, you know, the vitamin K to help the D3, the vitamin C, the B12, like these things that I love it because it, when you watch those commercials for those sugar cereals, like whatever it is, Fruity Pebbles or something, right? It says it's being fortified with essential vitamins and minerals, right?
Oh, that's essential. It's racist. Come on.
Yeah, right. No. It's like, but fortified with, you know, essential vitamins and minerals, because you could live off Fruity Pebbles if you had to, right?
Yeah.
Why? Because they put the stuff that you actually need in it, because it wouldn't have any value otherwise. But those things that you really need, the essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, are what is the key to preventing a COVID type of reaction for you. And so that's what we've been doing forever and a day, you know, now. And we've been involved in homeopathic types of Eastern medicine here for a long time. At our house, we don't like Western medicine.
Yeah.
We got treated in Korea for different stuff, and it worked really well, you know. Eastern medicine is the way to go. I mean, if you break your leg, well, then Western medicine is great. Yeah, they're going to, you know, orthopedic surgeons and, you know, these guys are fantastic. But when it comes into the FDA approval over these things that, you know, I mean, give me a break, the FDA. Oh, wow. How much time do we have? Because we could oh, my God.
Yeah, it's funny. FDA. It took Fauci, what, seven, almost 8 months to come out and say, what every breakfast cereal since we were kids has been saying. Yeah, you need vitamins and minerals. Yeah, you need zinc and vitamin C and D.
Yeah.
And everybody is all like, oh, they're kissing the ring because the great Fauci said it. I'm like, man, if you needed him to tell you that, you have got deeper problems. Come on, man.
Right.
Of course you need C, D, and zinc. Come on.
Yeah. You know, the idea that somehow – the information has changed by virtue of Now, this is really funny because I lived just off the Belt Parkway in Bath Beach, Brooklyn. Right, very close. We lived in Bay Ridge for almost 20 years, and then we sort of just moved like one or two neighborhoods away before we moved down to North Carolina. And at the time, Ebola was coming in to Kennedy, right? There was cases.
I remember that, yeah.
Ebola. Now, I talk about the Mayan virus. I talk about being scared. When Ebola was just down the Belt Parkway from where I was living, I was concerned. I was genuinely like, wait a second. Like, if this is some real stuff, like bleeding out of every orifice, you know, projectile shooting blood out of your eyeballs and as your internals liquefy, I was starting to like go, man, that's legitimate. You know, like that is, you know, a true fear, you know, type of based thing. And the reaction that I was seeing, you know, and then you got I think it was the mayor of Houston. They had an issue where he actually made an appearance at a place that was infected in an actual apartment building where they had tested a positive Ebola. I literally was scared for Ebola for what it was. You know, obviously you don't want your daughter, you know, having her insides liquefied and shooting blood out of her. I mean, that's a horrible death. But you start, you know, researching into certain types of things that, you know, this colloidal silver and non-colloidal silver, the old folks of the world, I went to a friend of my mom's who passed away last year, went to a friend of hers house, and I was like, hey, have you heard about the silver stuff? She's like, I've been on silver for, you know, years and years and years. So it seems like, you know, the more that, you know, you live, you hear about that silver stuff. And
yeah, that's the truth.
Yeah, there's a rumor that a philanthropist in Nigeria provided silver for the country. And that's why there was no sort of Ebola outbreak in Nigeria. Now, I've read several different incarnations of that because the guy didn't want to be sort of known. He's a Nigerian billionaire or something like that. So the authenticity of that. So we'll leave it to the viewers. We'll see. Yeah, leave a comment below.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. I don't know how this stuff works. I'm new to this. I've never Zoomed. This is my first time Zooming.
Yeah, man. I mean, this is kind of off track, but it always makes me wonder because I'm like you. I do all kinds of natural supplements and everything, and I know my parents are on kind of a similar battery to what you were talking about with the C and the zinc and everything, because they're a little older and we don't want anything to happen to them. So they've been doing that for a while too. Yeah. Same thing in my house. But is there not any sort of, and I hate to say conservative because that's not the right word. I don't know. Like right of Mao, health food establishment anywhere. I swear, man, it's so bizarre to me how, it seems like it's all communist that's like, oh, we're into nature and naturopath and homeopath and organic non-GMO foods. And I keep thinking, man, if I had a lot of money, I would open a all natural health food store that was, I don't want to say right, but again, right of Mao, not completely communist where it's like you have to wear a mask. You can't come in without a mask, 6 feet apart, wear the beekeeper outfit. No guns allowed. No weapons allowed. Nothing allowed. Don't come in here unless you believe what we say. I mean, that's kind of like the signage that I get at some of these places. And I'm just going, man, well, if I had some money, I would open up that store and I would call it something. I don't know.
I think the eco aspect, you know, with the right sort of science behind it is definitely the way to go. You know, like sort of, you know, having, you know, certain things that are overdone to a degree that you don't want things to go the way of the dodo bird. You know what I mean? You literally, you don't want to go, you know, tasty, you know, land, you know, animal that we can beat over the head with a stick and have in 5 minutes. The idea of what Earth is to be respected. So I do, you know, I hear that, but to use it as a sort of gaslighting to get a massive sacrifice of, when you look at the carbon footprint, which is something that gets talked about all the time,
Oh, yeah.
The carbon footprint, your carbon footprint. Like, you know, I own a Tesla, so my carbon footprint is much less than your Mustang, you know, Hunter. And you know, actually, that's not correct, you know. So people will use the sort of information du jour to sort of cancel out what the actual facts are. So, the facts are to generate certain types of electricity, fossil fuels are needed, right? And you know, of course, my favorite meme is the diesel generator with the Tesla hookup, where they're actually burning the diesel to charge the Teslas. I'm like, this is not
what this is intended,
right? But, you know, the sort of preying on the good nature of people is really – It's the game. It is the game. It's the same thing about, you know, antagonizing people to disagree with their neighbors. Also, the sort of intentional preying on them to formulate an idea that promotes change. And that change is not normally what they say that it's going to be. It's headed in a funky direction. So, the manipulation of the human condition is so laid out. It's so predictable. G. Edward Griffin did an interview with a KGB person that was actually very high up in the sort of stratosphere of doing the psyops and the programming here in America. And he said, I think it was in the 1980s, he said to G. Edward Griffin, I cannot believe the amount of success that these programs have had in America, that the acceptance to sort of use these ideas that are going to be harmful at some point. He went on to elaborate it at great lengths, but the bad news is that our folks that are generally good, if you're a generally good person, you treat people generally well, and you generally are nice at the laundromat, grocery store, you go out to dinner and, yeah, hey, Steve, hey, Ted, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're generally a nice person.
Sure.
You have no idea of what evil is. You, and that's where the preying comes in. That's where the ability to prey on Steve or Bill or Bob, because of their general nature of being good and nice to everyone, they don't know what actual evil is. They don't know, just like the dodo bird, that, hey, these dudes walking around with these sticks, you know, might hurt me. They don't have that inside. And that is the big time human condition failure right now. That's what you're watching. I'm not pulling against people that aren't aware. You know, I'm sort of praying for them to get that what is it, a hyperphylactic response. It's either fight or run. You know, you're either going to, like, it's on or I'm out of here. You know, they've got to figure it out. And so the human condition, by being so good-natured, is so easily manipulated. So by being good, you don't know it, but you fall into these categories where they, like the KGB, you know, person, the G. Edward Griffin, just writes category after category. Like, I didn't think it would be this easy to completely infiltrate and take over the United States of America. To every single box. It's because they use your good-natured approach about yourself to completely gut you. And that's, you know, I'm really thankful for living in New York. You know, I got to see, you know, real sort of dangerous type of scary stuff. And I'm like, wow, this person doesn't care whether, you know, I'm like, hey, how are you? No, they'll kill me in a second. I've seen that.
I mean, that's the thing. I think we've had it so easy for so many generations now. We're just kind of just complacent. Okay, we got our paper and our internet and our sports, job. We're good. We don't need to worry about the food and the vaccines and the tyrannical government and the loss of civil liberties and all that stuff. I mean, that's, I mean, to your point, I definitely wasn't in New York, but I spent way too much time on the street corners.
Yeah.
And I think it gave me that perspective as well, because it gave me that total difference from my home life and where things were cushy, nice, and wonderful. You get out there and you spend enough time on the street corner, like you just said, like, you're going to see a whole lot of bad stuff, like the fights, people getting cut and shot, police beating people's heads in and just insanity.
Right.
But it does give you that different perspective. Like you said, like it gives you that like, oh, okay, like this is a facade, that whole Matrix thing. Like most people are in that proverbial blue pill. And sadly, I don't think they want the red pill. They don't want to know. I mean, I've talked to people before that are just kind of like, hey, I don't want to know about it. I just want my cereal and my GMO and my vaccines, and I'll live for 65 point whatever years and check out, and it'll be great. That's not where I'm at, because like you know, I got family and a child, and, you know, like we kind of, to come full circle here, we talked at the beginning, you know, we're starting to get to that age where we really do have to start looking at that next generation and go, hey, I don't want my kids to live in this cesspool, even if I do check out in 10 years or whatever, you know, I don't want to, but, you know, it's a bigger picture, I think, once you get to our demographic, for sure.
You know, it almost goes back into that sort of scared to be an evangelist moment that I had live on your show. You know, I had to sort of, you know, bring that right to that, because those things are real. Like, that's almost the sort of programming that I received to sort of, oh, you know, don't chirp, you know, up about God. You know, don't, you know, sort of do those things. Like, sometimes in some circles, you know, they're like, oh, you know, the church and state, you know, the church itself, you know, all of the negatives, you know, and so there's so much that sort of circulates in your own head about when you want to be an evangelist, you know, when you want to say that, you know, God saved your life, when you want to give credit to the Most High, you know, I mean, so now it's a different place for me, because, you know, I was, you know, this guy, you know, this, you know, rock and roll dude who listened to Iron Maiden, you know, and always, you know, doing that. And,
of course.
And as a kid, you know, I didn't, it was innocent, you know, it really was an innocent type of thing. You know, I loved, you know, Judas Priest and, you know, all the sort of whatever. And of course, you know, the Van Halen, which wasn't the sort of evil depiction, you know, they were more like the rock and roll Americana. But so rock and roll did have this sort of negative connotation, and now, you know, I look at it and I go, man, what was I thinking? You know, I was like, you know, I appreciate the music to this day, but as far as like trying to actually sit there and be a God-fearing Christian and sort of raise my hand up in some sort of way that, you know, like, you know what? You know, if I'm going to raise my hand up now, it's going to be to God and to give, you know, glory to God. And I'm not going to be ashamed about it. You know, I'm going to do rock and roll. You know, I'm going to do rock and roll. I'm going to do it for the Lord. You know, I don't need to give any sort of credit to the person that runs the earth, so to speak. Bob Dylan on 60 Minutes said that there is a person that rules this world and that he did a deal with it. Right.
Yeah. Everybody can find that. That's very easy to find, by the way, folks.
Bob Dylan, 60 Minutes, says that he did a deal with the devil. It's not a joke. So the fact of the real good versus evil, the people that don't want to participate, that just want to be left alone, that just want to do that sort of stuff, they're really sort of cementing not advancing. If life was a video game and you want to be that person that sort of a centrist, so no, I'm not with the devil and I'm not with the Lord. You know, if you don't stand for something, you're going to fall for anything. And that's that person. That person is not going to advance to that sort of next level. You know, right now, I've never been more sure that this is a spiritual world that we live in. People look at it and go, oh, it's hard. You know, there's things, you know, around here that are hard. They view it as like a hard carbon type of world, but it's really a liquid world. You know, this world that we are in is really liquid, and our wavelengths, this is where some people are like, you're talking wavelengths? So important.
It's true.
Really, really important. And how, there's a great book, The Hidden Messages in Water. A Japanese doctor actually programmed water molecules to imprint. Very incredible book. And I mean, it's on YouTube. You can find it. The Hidden Messages in Water. Incredible types of study that proves that we are influenced by water, that water actually can influence us. And, once you start, you know, going down those rabbit holes, you know, everything else is really amazing. I believe that this is God's earth, and he's put that other being here to tempt us. The Adam and Eve thing, you know, really is that you're given the opportunity to have freedom of choice, to have free will. What are you going to do with it? How is that next level obtained if you didn't have free will to be able to do this? So I look at the people that are doing it maliciously from that angle of hurting someone else versus the people that are doing it unknowingly. So there's people that are contributing to bad things happening, but are they actively malicious in trying to force that? Or is it a sort of, like you said before, hey, I don't want anything to do with it type of thing. So I believe that we are being faced with a choice of what you're going to do. And this is real. This is real.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've probably seen this in the music, but I mean, we're all well aware of what's going on with the actors, actresses, all the musicians. I mean, I always sort of think of it as like, is this all there is? You know, like whatever you get fed on your radio. And there was a good documentary about this that basically talked about, hey, why does that song in your head? Oh, well, it's because it's probably written by one of five people. And then it's sold the rights to at Old Navy and at Walmart and at wherever else plays music. So you're hearing that in the car. If you're getting the radio stations, which are all owned by a few different conglomerates, and then you go to the store and you go to the whatever outing you're out, it's the same stinking song.
Right.
And like you said to the Bob Dylan thing, most of these people are only going to get to a certain plateau, if you will, based on their own merits, and then they're going to have that conversation. So, I mean, it's, for me, just revolting, the music that's out there now. And I know I'm probably somebody, I sound like a really old geezer here, but yeah, like most of the music now is just complete garbage. But, you know, it comes to that same point. Like, is this all that's out there? Like, no. I mean, I'm sure there's an amazing artist in Omaha, Nebraska, that's never going to get spotted or found or end up in Madison Square Garden or whatever. And there's a great person in Alabama that's a beautiful singer at a gospel church that we're never going to hear.
Yeah.
But we're going to get what they want you to hear, whatever that completely controlled, compromised person is that's going to regurgitate that message, that same stuff we've been talking about, you know, the follow the communist agenda, just take the vaccine, abortion's great, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I mean, it really does circle back into that good versus evil paradigm that we talked about.
Yeah, and something that gets overlooked tremendously, John, is that the actual music itself in a tonal capacity has been corrupted. So most people that hear that and they go, what? In a tonal capacity, it's been corrupted. The Italian Music Federation, the people that used to run music like back in the day, the definitive sort of source for everything, had always had a formula for what A equals. A equals a certain hertz level, as it's called. And it got changed. The official Italian tunings, musical standardized tunings, have been corrupted. The original music through composition, which gave you incredible spectrum analysis of chords, like the most beautiful types of images, just like the hidden messages in water. Look, the cordular image at a certain hertz rate is beautiful. Music is beautiful. It affects the soul. It affects the incredible things about the human condition, the human psyche, the connection to God in music. But it was corrupted and taken from 432 hertz to 440 hertz, which actually changed all of the cordular imaging, changed all of what music actually was. A lot of your listeners probably know about this, but if you look it up, 432 hertz versus 440, you will find that the actual connection to your soul through music has been corrupted. They don't want music affecting you the way that it should, right? you should be able to connect with music to our creator very easily, right? But through the corruption of the tuning, the master tuning of music, they have basically done Satan's will and allowed it to be ugly. The spectral analysis of the chords at 440 are so ugly, horrible. They've taken music and they've ruined it by tuning it differently. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely it does.
So you know here at Summer Hill, you know at this at our studio right here, guess what? We're tuned to the Lord's frequency, right? This place runs on 432. The master tuning for my montage, which is a keyboard just here to the left, I don't think you can see it. Every single instrument in this entire place, all guitars, all basses, all everything is tuned to 432 hertz equals A. And when people come here, they go, we just recorded a local band around here last week, and they heard everything, and they were like, I was playing some songs before we actually, but they were like, really liking what they heard. And I didn't tell them anything about the tuning differential, but when people come here and it starts hitting you and it's whole, it's real, its origin is from God. Music, I believe, is from God. And I don't really know how to tell you how blessed I've been. I've never been a music theory guy. I don't read music, but I play every instrument. Right. So I've spent this time and developed these relationships with instruments and somehow been allowed to move on and can continue to sort of advance and to layer that knowledge and connection. Really, sometimes I feel as I'm playing that I look at my hand and I kind of go, it feels like I'm not really me.
Yeah.
That's like the strangest thing to say. But sometimes I feel like when I'm playing that I actually am sort of watching myself in quantum physics. It's called the observer, right? So if you're into quantum physics, the observer is something that's very, very important into what's going on into the whole scheme of things. It doesn't miss much. So I'll be looking at my hand not as the active participant, but as the observer. And It's pretty weird. I mean, honestly, when you play music for an awfully long time, you can sort of think about other things as you're playing and sort of, get to that, sort of position. You know what? I think I might even have you want to hear something?
Sure.
All right. This is something. You guys might recognize something like that there. I don't know how the audio is going to be or whatever, but we'll give you some little tones because I just turned it on and turned it up. Is it coming through? How's it going?
Oh, yeah, sounds good.
Miss Yeti.
I like it, man. I like it.
Well, that's just some fun stuff, but the connection is not about pieces of paper and writing. It's about, it's about God. And, music for me now has a new direction, and it's about the man upstairs. And when I was trying to do it for me, and I got my foot in the door in some neat places, I look back on it, and I had an ego, like where I would edge God out. What does ego stand for? Edge God out. You're thinking about yourself, all the things you can do. You've taken God out of your life, right? And so consequently, I didn't get that next move or that one sort of big thing. But as soon as God became, it makes me even choke up a little bit. As soon as God becomes number one, The doors open. The things that were no's before turn into yeses. The blessings start to happen. This place where we are right now, Summer Hill, was a dream. It's an absolute dream. You know, having my own recording studio where we can concentrate on golf and music. I mean, what kind of place is that? You know what I mean? Is that, it's like Willy Wonka built this place or something, but it's so over the top as far as the blessing that it could only come from that place of the Most High, and he gets all the credit. You know, the Lord gets all the credit, and I'm so blessed and so thankful.
Well, I know we're running short of time, but we got to talk about this a little bit. I know your mom was a big influence with us as well, but what led you to the Lord? What was that turning moment? What did it look like for you?
You know, there was a moment, and it's kind of different for everybody. You know, my wife, if you ask my wife, you know, she had her moment, to her sort of personal experience with the Lord. And it's difficult to sort of talk about those things, because if you talk about them, you know, some people be like, oh, you know, like, oh, you know, that wasn't real, or blah, blah, blah. You know, so I'll leave it a little bit sort of unrevealed as to the nature of both of our content. Very different, by the way, like how, you know, my wife got dialed in to the Lord 100%, how I got dialed in, completely different. My wife was having an incredible a bad day. She was having a lot of anxiety. She had a huge test. She was in the school systems in New York City, and this was one of her big tests to get in as a teacher or to work with special needs kids. So she was really nervous, and she was really, you know, just, and she had a moment and describes it at great length to where she knew everything would be all right. And from that moment on, my wife is been involved with the church as far as helping kids, having me, you know, sort of do, you know, different types of things, you know, with the church, whether it's teaching golf or music or doing Sunday school programming or whatever. So she knew a little bit before me as far as her direct sign. But for me, it was, it was really easy. I was doing, you know, things where I was still thinking about myself. You know, more or less, how am I going to do it? All the pressure's on my shoulders. I've got to, you know, feed a family or, you know, at least, you know, head a household types of stuff. So there's this great self-induced type of pressure that can keep you without your eye on God. And, for me, honestly, it was in Brooklyn on 67th Street and Fifth Avenue. Took a shower, getting ready to go to work. And I opened up my shower. The showers in Brooklyn, they have these boilers, right? So they will toast your skin off if you're not careful. You gotta be real careful. So really steamy in the shower. So I turn off the shower, open the thing, and in the mirror, there was an image. And at first, I didn't know what the image was, right? So I was completely scared. I knew something was like, there's no, somebody came in the bathroom, basically drew a picture on the mirror is what it looked like. But I sort of screamed as I got out of the shower and was scared. My wife came in and she saw the image in the actual mirror. And, you know, we do have photographs of this image. But that, from that moment on, I sort of knew, I was like, hey, you can be anywhere at any place or whatever, and the Lord can find you. You know, that's sort of what I got from that. And not in a hunt you down type of way, but in a you finding him type of way. Mm-hmm. So once that strange little, and I mean, could it be written off in a bunch of other, you know, directions that, you know, if you're doing Mythbusters or whatever, you say, oh yes, you know, a pigeon flew in and whatever, you know, so, you know, there's some way that somebody could debunk it, but the personal sort of aspect to it, to me, was a sign that the Lord is with you, you know, so it wasn't like, you know, some, you know, oil on the head, you know, type of thing. It wasn't some, you know, crazy, you know, spectacular scene from a movie. it was really just an image in a steamy mirror, and not that big of a deal as far as what it was in that day, but as far as what it meant to me, it gave me the knowledge and peace that, hey, no matter where I am, that it's okay, that everything's good, you know. And that was just the connection to the Lord. Like, maybe I wasn't connected before that.
That's beautiful, man. It sounds like you got just what you needed.
Well,
you
I've never
the, the burning bush or the anointing with oil and all that, you know, fantastical stuff. That's beautiful.
No, you know, it's you know, my wife has a very different story, you know, with sort of an interaction type of, you know, what she saw. And, you know, for me, it wasn't exactly that, but it was all that I needed to see to sort of know that, you know, the path of rock and roll and all this sort of other stuff is not, you know, the holy path. And if you take God first, you know, God wants to rock and roll. God wants to rock and roll, but he wants you to understand that you rock because of him. You know what I mean? Like that. I kind of get that now. You know, I thought I rocked because of me before, but no. Now I know that I rock because of God. And once you sort of swallow that holy red pill, man, the world it's just better. It's just a different place. I mean, the outlook. I wake up every day, like, excited to mow the lawn or do, you know, it's like, wow, this is great. You know, I'm like, man, you know. And I always look in the, you know, it's been years and years, but if there's, like, ever a steamy mirror, you know, I give it an extra look. Hey, you know, don't know if you're getting a
that
report.
That is cool, man. I like it. It's beautiful, man.
It is what it is. I'm just blessed, really blessed.
Well, how can everybody find out more about you? How can they follow what you do and all that good stuff?
Well, HunterWatkins.com is the website. It needs to be updated, but I mean, you can find some of my videos and, you know, the instructional stuff for golf at HunterWatkins.com or Summer Hill Golf on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, some of my newer stuff, in fact, some of the we've done, we've gone to the school systems here in North Carolina and actually done a golf program to where we taught the entire fourth, fifth grade at one of our local elementaries and introduced the idea of using music to teach golf. And the kids just freaked out. You know, they're like, wow, music to teach golf? Like, you know, the word I kept hearing, like, I thought golf wasn't cool. And I'm like, yeah, like, golf is totally cool, man. I don't know what you're talking about. We rock when we play golf, you know. But the Summer Hill Golf on YouTube, HunterWatkins.com, and I don't know. Maybe more stuff coming soon. I don't know.
Well, that's great, man. I love it. I've had a great conversation. We got to do it again.
John, thank you for asking me to come on. Hopefully you can fit my hair in the screen there.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. It's looking good, man. Looking good. Well, if you'll hold off for a second off air, I will talk to you in just a minute. I'll wrap things up here.
You got it, man.
All right. So, if you missed all that, fear not. You can check out anomicage.com. You can find all the information about Hunter Watkins there, all the links that he just mentioned, the video, the audio, all the other guests, and much, much more. Anomicage.com. So please check that out and share the link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. As I always say, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So please try to get out there and do your part and make that difference. Until next time, I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to the Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to the Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more.